Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the brinkmanship underway as the Senate votes on raising the debt ceiling, which has to be done by midnight on Thursday, otherwise the government will run out of money by mid-October, and the economy will be in a financial crisis worse than 2008. Joining us is Mike Lofgren, who spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate Budget Committees. The author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. We will discuss the possible workaround McConnell's refusal to raise the limit the Democrats could employ by having President Biden and the Treasury invoke the clearly stated text of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which says, quote, "The validity of the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned." Predictably, McConnell would take it to the Supreme Court, which is now reliably partisan, even though they claim to be originalists who follow the text of the Constitution. But at least we would be borrowing some time before the full faith and credit of the United States crashes and burns. Then we'll speak with Max Shafkin, a features editor and tech reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek, about his new book just out, The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. With the billionaire backer of the alt-right and Trump now financing far-right candidates running for the U.S. Senate in Arizona and Ohio, we will assess how the ultimate plutocratic populist Thiel could replace the Koch brothers who financed the old Republican Party as the money behind the new radical neo-fascist GOP in support of far-right populists like Tucker Carlson and Governor DeSantis. Then finally, we'll get an update from Berlin on Sunday's elections in Germany with Michael Wirz, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who has been a senior transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund, where his work focused on transatlantic foreign policy and the European Union. He joins us to discuss how the Social Democrats made a surprise comeback and will likely form a government with the Greens and the Liberals, which means, as the coalitions are formed, Chancellor Merkel will remain in office until November or December. And before we go to our first guest, while Background Briefing remains a nationally syndicated radio program with a growing national and international audience, we are relying more and more on our online and podcast audience to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. Joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate Budget Committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina, disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. And he's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And he has an article at Common Dreams, For the 17th Time, Afghanistan Was Never Winnable. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for joining us, Mike. And as we speak now, the Senate is voting on raising the debt ceiling. It has to be done by midnight on Thursday night. And apparently the government will run out of money in mid-October if they don't raise the ceiling. But we're already getting warnings from Wall Street that if the government doesn't raise the debt ceiling, they'll create a financial crisis worse than 2008. This has prompted the Secretary of Treasury to meet with McConnell, along with two former Republican Secretaries of the Treasury, Paulson and Mnuchin, to weigh in on McConnell, telling him not to do it. But McConnell is pretty adamant. He's actually said, if they, the Democrats, want to tax, borrow, and spend historic sums of money without our input, they will have to raise the debt limit without our help. So that's what's happening now as we speak. And what do you think will be the, I mean, you don't, I don't think there's any doubt about the outcome of this vote. In other words, the Democrats won't get the 60 votes. That's pretty clear, is it not?
I believe it is. Now, Mark Zandi, who's a pretty clever financial analyst, said if we default, there could be a global depression where $15 trillion of American wealth is lost and the unemployment rate goes up to 9%. That is what a pretty neutral financial analyst says. This is basically financial terrorism. Republicans in the 80s and 90s, they made a bit of noise, but there was always this coming together of increasing the debt limit. And we've always had a debt increase. America has always carried the debt, other than in 1835 and 1836, when Andrew Jackson basically destroyed the Second Bank of the United States. And that created the panic of 1837 and a big depression. Okay? And it's very odd that Andrew Jackson was the idol of Steve Bannon, who kind of said, this is how you've got to govern, to Donald Trump. So we're in a very perilous situation right now.
Well, there's always been posturing and brinkmanship over this. And in 2006, under President George W. Bush, the Democrats, including Biden, voted against increasing the debt limit. They eventually, and when the Republicans had to pass the debt limit increase along party lines. Obviously, the Democrats have a problem and they can't pass it on party lines except through reconciliation. And that takes a long time. And they've already got their big $3.5 trillion stimulus bill and the voting rights bill tied up in that. So we can see what McConnell's tactics are to gum up the works. But are there any alternatives here?
There is an alternative, because as I said, we've always had a debt, and there was no debt limit public law until 1917. That was the Second Liberty Bond Act, which created this, you know, monstrosity unknown in the rest of the developed world, where the parliament has to vote to increase the debt limit. But that is superseded by the Constitution. The 14th Amendment, after the Civil War, says that the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned. And that is very clear. And it says that basically the congressmen of the southern states who were reunited and accepted back into the Union could not vote to repudiate Union war debts. And that totally supersedes, trumps, if you will, the whole notion of a public law. And when it says it shall not be questioned, that means by no one. That means it's not just Congress's thing. It means the Treasury and the White House have to take care that the public debt is not in question internationally.
Okay, so let's go through this scenario. They've got the Constitution on their side, the Biden White House. What do? Unilaterally say, we, through the Treasury Department, are increasing the debt limit. And then what does McConnell do?
He would probably file suit, and it would go up to the Supreme Court. You know, given the appointees who are now Republicans, who knows how it would be decided. But I think that would be, you know, the last resort.
Well, but if we've got till Thursday at midnight, so this had better happen pretty quickly. And as I mentioned,
well, I don't think the debt limit does. It's the operation of the government. They can pass that without the debt limit. The debt limit, the Treasury can do some tricks and extend it into October. Nevertheless, I agree with you, very soon it must be extended.
Well, given this right-wing Supreme Court, I mean, I don't know that you could trust them.
Yes, that is a question.
I mean, it's, even if it's they're supposed to be originalists, and this is in the 14th Amendment, it's pretty clear, it's unambiguous. But again, they're ideologues, political operatives in robes. So I don't know whether Biden can pull that string, do you? I mean, it sounds like something that at least should be discussed here. I mean, I'm sick of the brinksmanship. I think everybody is. It's so irresponsible.
Well, we're into new territory here. That's why I left Congress in 2011.
Right.
Because of the debt limit vote at that time. And I thought that Republicans were going to pull the string and basically put the United States into sovereign default.
Well, they're doing it as we
speak.
So
this is a big deal.
Right. And they're doing it as we speak. And I'm not sure what tools the Democrats have to avoid it. It seems like the idea at the end of the day that the Republicans will do the right thing, that's water under the bridge. Those days are over, right?
Right. This is legislative terrorism. It's basically like holding somebody hostage and saying you're going to shoot them. They don't care anymore.
Well, yeah, this is...
I mean, if you see a party that approves of insurrection, violent insurrection in the Capitol, and literally defecating on the floors and attacking policemen, if they approve of that and they think these people are political prisoners, why wouldn't they vote against the debt limit?
Well, McConnell is all about the politics of sabotage. So I can see him making the calculation that we won't raise the debt limit, the economy crashes, and the voters vote Biden and the Democrats out because of a destroyed economy. But and somehow or other, the public will forget the fact that it was the Republicans who destroyed the economy. That is their thinking. So at the end of the day, it seems like the only way out is what you're suggesting, which is to invoke the 14th Amendment.
Right. Just bowl through it with the 14th Amendment. The suit and the appeals would take so much time that basically the economy would glide along, I think.
Well, Mark Lofgren, I thank you for joining us. And as I say, as we speak now, the Senate is voting, although it's predetermined how they'll vote. But this is the ultimate in shooting yourself in the foot. And I thank you for joining us.
No, it's like shooting yourself in the head.
Okay. I stand corrected. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And he has an article at Common Dreams for the 17th time, Afghanistan Was Never Winnable. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with Max Chafkin about the ultimate plutocratic populist, Peter Thiel, who could replace the Koch brothers who financed the old Republican Party as the money behind the new radical neo-fascist GOP in support of far-right populists like Tucker Carlson and Governor DeSantis. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Max Chafkin, who is a features editor and tech reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek, whose work has also appeared in Fast Company, Vanity Fair, Inc., and the New York Times Magazine, and he's the author of the new book just out, The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Chafkin.
Thanks for having me, Ian. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And one of the most interesting aspects to your extraordinary book, which is not just about Peter Thiel, but about the culture of Silicon Valley and how the sort of revealing the dark side of these techno-utopians that have become, I mean, it's extraordinary to think that, you know, what, only a decade or so ago, the biggest companies in the world were ExxonMobil and others, traditional, powerful international corporations. And now all these tech companies are the most powerful corporations in the world, Apple, Google, Facebook, and Microsoft. But let me start out with the politics here, because we have a peculiar situation in this country where a defeated president controls the Republican Party. They're engaged in massive voter suppression, and they may well win in 2022 and 2024. And some people even think that we could end up with a one-party state in this country. And this, given the far-right politics of Peter Thiel, who's been a sort of figure in the background throughout the Trump administration, could he be playing a bigger role in reaching that goal? Would he be happy with that outcome?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that at least in terms of the role he's playing, and then I'll get to the authoritarianism question in a second. But yeah, Thiel is sort of setting himself up to be kind of to play the role that I'd say like the Koch brothers played with the kind of traditional Republican Party in the 90s and 2000s, where you have this kind of business project that's funding a bunch of advocacy, and that advocacy is kind of feeding back into the business. Thiel's kind of trying to do that to some extent with the Trumpist right, with the kind of nationalist populist part of the Republican Party, which, as you said, is ascendant. I mean, it really is. Seems like they have control of the party. That this faction may even be growing, despite the obvious, you know, problems that Trump had at the end of his presidency, the obvious failures and the January 6th insurrection. None of that has seemed to matter to voters, and frankly, none of that has seemed to matter to Peter Thiel, who managed to kind of extricate himself from Trump world without kind of getting this sort of tarnish of the end of the Trump presidency, and is out there backing these hard right Senate candidates. There are two key races in particular, one in Arizona and one in Ohio, where Thiel has given $10 million to each candidate. Blake Masters in Arizona, J.D. Vance in Ohio. Both these guys have worked for Thiel. Blake Masters still works for Thiel. J.D. Vance is runs a venture capital firm where Thiel is a significant investor. They're big financial ties, and ideologically, you know, they are very, very similar. You know, they're pushing kind of hard right on immigration, you know, build the wall, send the immigrants back, that kind of thing. They're talking about kind of cultural populism, which has always been a big thing for Peter Thiel. So, you know, complaining about, say, cancel culture and things like that. And of course, they're pushing in general policies that would benefit Thiel and his allies. You know, Vance has been a big supporter of crypto, for instance. So which is an area where Thiel likes to play. So they are potentially going to play a role in 2022. And whether or not they win, and the jury definitely is out on whether they'll win. Thiel is kind of establishing himself as you know, one of the key patrons, you know, a key donor that any Republican candidate who wants to have a serious chance of winning an election or a primary will have to kind of contend with and will have to try to cater to.
But we don't know exactly. We've seen the people who stormed the Capitol on January the 6th, and the FBI has got several hundred of them under investigation. Some are being tried and some are in jail. But the House Select Committee, looking into January the 6th, just subpoenaed Bannon and a few other Meadows and a few other White House officials. And is there any possibility that Thiel's money and influence will show up? Because the missing piece of the puzzle, we saw the kind of equivalent of the American brown shirts, a bizarre bunch of riffraff defecating and desecrating the Capitol. But we don't know about the financing and the brains behind it all. The day before, of course, Stephen Bannon said, all hell is going to break loose tomorrow. they have a relationship, Bannon and Thiel, and I'm wondering whether this website that's been hacked, Epic, the internal records of Epic's exposing all these far-right trolls, there's tons and tons of paperwork is coming out of it.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is about who's been financing the far-right. So is it possible that we'll learn more about Peter Thiel's fingerprints?
So absolutely possible, but I don't think it's guaranteed that he would show up in that Epic data dump. I will say his fingerprints, while not sort of directly involved, like I don't know of a direct financing of any of the groups that, you know, that stormed the U.S. Capitol, that, you know, unsuccessfully tried to, you know, overturn the result of a Democratic election. But indirectly, he definitely, his fingerprints are all over it. So Thiel is a financial backer and has been a financial backer of this guy, Curtis Yarvin, who better known as Mencius Moldbug. He's a far right blogger who founded a company that Thiel backed. And Yarvin, you know, not long before the January 6th insurrection, wrote this kind of long essay I talk about in the book, where it's sort of treating the idea of an attempted coup as a thought experiment. It's like, ha ha ha, this will never happen, but this is what Trump should do. And it is chilling, you know, in retrospect, to read it, because it really does kind of embrace a lot of the ideology, and not just ideology, but the methods of this crew. We're also seeing support, kind of softer support, but support nonetheless from these candidates who Thiel is backing. You know, where they're not kind of coming out and saying, the January 6th insurrectionists were right, but they're sort of defending that, you know, aspects of it as peaceful protest. You know, there's sort of a shading of what actually happened. And there is, you know, kind of a clear effort by these Thiel-backed candidates to diminish and malign the results of the 2020 election. So Blake Masters running for Senate. One of his opponents is Mark Brnovich, who's the Attorney General of Arizona. Masters is running these ads that a Masters PAC that Thiel backed with a $10 million donation is running these ads where Brnovich is basically criticized for doing his job, which is certifying the election results. It's like he wasn't willing to, you know, quote unquote, investigate the supposed fraud, and therefore you should vote him out. So it's, they're not quite, you know, going, you know, the full, you know, insurrectionist route or whatever, but they are definitely trying to kind of have it both ways, right? Where they want to embrace the energy without having to sort of take responsibility for the actions of these people and to really reckon, you know, with what happened on January 6th and also what could happen again if these ideas continue to proliferate and continue to gather strength.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Shafkin, who is a features editor and tech reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek, whose work has also appeared in Fast Company, Vanity Fair, Inc., and the New York Times Magazine, and he's the author of the new book just out, The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. So there's a new sort of concept in political science that comes from the Harvard political scientist Jacob Hacker, what she calls plutocratic populism. And that seems to sort of peg Thiel, does it not? Because your book makes it clear that he's sort of motivated more than anything else by owning the libs. And you say that he's sort of spoiling for a fight with whomever he designates as liberal, meaning anybody he suspects is snubbing him. And he views liberals through the lens of people who are not nice to him. And after the election, of course, of Trump, there was the deplorable that you write about, which he visited. And there again, Hillary Clinton's describing these people as deplorable, sort of, they wear it as a badge of honor. I mean, they would rather own the libs. And we're talking about, you know, millions of people in this country. In fact, the core of Trump's continuing support in the Republican Party, they would rather own the libs than have healthcare and childcare and dentistry and all this other stuff that the Democrats rather ineptly are trying to bring about. So
yeah, well, I think that term plutocratic populism is really apt, and I think it raises, you know, the obvious question, which is like, you know, why would somebody for whom like a populist would have appeal, why would they like somebody like Peter Thiel? I mean, he's a billionaire, right? He's not somebody who's worrying about the rights of the little guy. He's somebody who is really and very much in many ways, you know, protecting his own interests and doing so proudly. And I think that's actually one of the reasons why I think, you know, a study of Thiel, a book like this, is interesting, because there's a thing you didn't mention, which is that in addition to being this kind of, you know, hard right figure, this guy who's financed all these kind of troublemakers who have made it their business to kind of troll the left, or you know get under the skin of the libs or whatever. He has this amazing story, a personal story of success, right? And a big part of that appeal is the kind of gospel of success. So it isn't just isn't it great to you know go after the left? It's that doing so can make you rich and famous, you know. And Thiel has kind of connected this political worldview with his own kind of financial story of success as being, you know, the co-founder of PayPal, the first investor in Facebook, this really amazing technologist. And I think a lot for the people who kind of buy into the story, they don't see it as they see it as plutocratic populism, maybe, but they want to become plutocrats themselves. And Thiel has kind of put out this message that they can too. And I don't think, obviously, I think that that is probably not true. You know, most of us are unfortunately not going to be as wealthy as Peter Thiel, but he has kind of set up this on-ramp where it's possible to imagine yourself, you know, also becoming one of these, you know, techno-libertarian gods, these builder types that he celebrates so much.
Well, clearly, even though he didn't end up having a lot of influence, it seems, over the Trump administration, he worked with Bannon and tried to get some of his people in there. I think he got one guy on the National Security Council. But nevertheless, Peter Thiel was one of the only one or two non-Trump family members in Trump Tower on the night of the unexpected victory, at which apparently Trump's wife, Melania, broke into tears. That's pretty telling. And then later, as your book that tells us, Max, he brought together a meeting in Trump Tower with all the big tech giants, with Bezos and a whole bunch of them. And he's sitting right next to Trump. And Apple's head, Tim Cook, was there as well. I mean, he had a lot of affinity with Trump.
Yeah.
Both Thiel and Bannon wanted the Trump administration to be even more radical. And
right. They
were disappointed. So what happened at that meeting, though? Why did all those other big tech guys, like Tim Cook of Apple and Bezos of Amazon, show up? I guess, what, pretty obvious, right? They wanted to have relations with the new administration.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, the question about sort of Thiel's success or failure in, you know, in the Trump administration is a really good one. I actually think I don't think he was in the White Trump Tower on election day, but as you say, he was, you know, very much in the inner circle, you know, one of the only kind of mainstream business figures to get anywhere near Trump during the campaign. And I think, you know, there is a question, right? Because as you said, he comes into the transition and the White House way out there, and in fact too far out there. You know, Steve Bannon was kind of, as you said, Thiel's ally, told me that, you know, Thiel was too, you know, if you thought what we were doing was crazy, you should have seen what Thiel was proposing. And I think on some level, right, that was a failure because he didn't get very many people, you know, involved in the White House. But then it almost feels like, I argued this in the book, that he was playing a different game. You know, he wasn't trying to, you know, stack the Trump administration full of allies. What he was playing for was influence. And we saw that influence come out, as you say, in this meeting in Trump Tower, where Thiel puts together a meeting of the biggest CEOs in tech. And then these are people who run the biggest companies basically in the world. And, you know, Tim Cook of Apple. We saw executives from Facebook, CEO of Microsoft, on and on. And also in this meeting is the CEO of Palantir, which is at the time a tiny little company, you know, definitely not on the level, not even close to the level of these big players. But of course, is one in which Peter Thiel has a huge interest in. He was and is the largest shareholder at the time. You know, owned something like 20% of the company. And getting in that room with Donald Trump and being able to make a pitch on the level of the other big tech companies, I think very much helped Palantir. The company from that point on got a number of enormous contracts. You know, more than $1 billion worth of government contracts, saw its value skyrocket, and therefore Thiel's net worth soar. So, you know, there's a way to say, you know, okay, maybe he failed in the political game, but maybe that wasn't really his game. Maybe his game was economic. And I think when you look at the Trump presidency kind of in its full trajectory, you got to say that was the right call, because people who allied themselves or who tied themselves politically, you know, very tightly with Trump have not done well. But somebody like Thiel, who kind of was able to get the cred from Trump, but stay on the outside, managed to get through with his net worth, you know, skyrocketing, and also maintaining his credibility with this ascendant part of the electorate without necessarily being tarnished by the failure. So in the end, you know, maybe it was an accident, maybe it was out of his own incompetence or political incompetence, or maybe it was strategic. You know, it kind of just all came up roses for him. And Thiel is such a strategic guy, you know, that I tend to think that he kind of planned it that way.
Well, there is this kind of ideological inconsistency, though, with Palantir, which is a data mining company that works with the CIA and the Department of Defense, which Thiel founded. Doesn't that sort of clash with his libertarian views?
Yes, it's completely inconsistent. And there are tons of these. There are tons of these inconsistencies when you start to sort of look closely at Peter Thiel's ideology. And, you know, he's basically, you know, has this enormous, you know, fan base, these guys, these young kids who, you know, want to be rich and famous and successful like him, who, you know, hang on his every word. And they'll go to great lengths to kind of try to stitch it all together. But I think you're right. I mean, I think there's nothing libertarian about a company that is backed by the CIA and, you know, makes its money by doing data mining for the U.S. government. In fact, you know, I think it'd be reasonable if you're concerned about privacy or personal liberty to be really worried about this company. And so I think that, you know, that has a couple of implications. One is, you know, I think Thiel is ideological, like he has these beliefs, but he also is a capitalist and a hedge fund person and somebody who, you know, who sees ideology and business kind of working together. So I think, you know, he's sort of willing to make compromises, including ideological compromises when they, you know, help his business. I also think Thiel is kind of commonly, you know, presented as a libertarian, and he's definitely, you know, talked about himself in that way. He backed Ron Paul, but libertarian is probably not the right word for Peter Thiel's politics. You know, he's in favor of certain liberty for billionaires to pay lower taxes. He's definitely in favor of less government regulation on certain parts of the economy, but he's also in favor of, you know, hawkish immigration policy. And he has, you know, expressed in all sorts of different ways and also funded people who have expressed, you know, real skepticism about democracy, kind of pushing this vision of, you know, some sort of, you know, executives, you know, a much stronger executive, you know, in other words, a dictator, as a preferable, you know, solution for the government. And we're seeing, you know, Republicans now talk about, you know, an American Caesar as a kind of thought experiment. And that idea, of course, is kind of like a nice way of talking about fascism, I guess. And that idea is being pushed, you know, by people who are close to Thiel and who is being taken very seriously, at least in some parts of the, you know, intellectual right where Thiel's playing a role.
Well, you're painting a picture, and I've run into these followers of Ayn Rand, and of course Peter Thiel was influenced by Ayn Rand when he was, I guess, maybe before or after he was at Stanford, when he ran a newspaper that was trolling the left. But the influence that he has over, or what appears to be influence over Mark Zuckerberg, is really more potent than anything, I think, in the fact that your book, Max, points out that Thiel, because he's the first investor in Facebook and has a relationship with Zuckerberg and has influenced him, I believe also Rupert Murdoch has also been a kind of mentor as well of Zuckerberg's, he's pushed Zuckerberg to the right. And how much can you make the case that the difficulty we have of getting rid of some of this toxic, hateful stuff that's on the internet that organizes and inspires the far right and the kind of people that storm the Capitol, Facebook has been quite truculent about getting rid of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, part of the reason I wrote this book, you know, is that I think there is an ideology. You're talking about kind of a right-left ideology. And I think Thiel has, you know, certainly, you know, influenced Zuckerberg in that direction. But there's another part of this ideology that I think is maybe even more salient, and it maybe, you know, has something to say to people of both political parties, because, you know, what Thiel has really argued and the thing that Zuckerberg has embraced is basically the supremacy of tech founders and in particular tech billionaires. This idea that if you start a tech company, you should be able to get away with anything. You should be able to do what it takes to bend the rules or even break the rules, you know, kind of disrupt the status quo as needed in order to, as he sees it, kind of make the future happen. And that ideology, that kind of like, you know, disrespect for institutions, for rules, you know, for the will of democratically elected lawmakers, I think is something that we see in Facebook today. And it's something that, you know, I think both, of course, the left has definitely focused a lot on that, but we're also seeing complaints on the right from, you know, kind of a totally different point of view, but it amounts to almost the same thing. And that's why I think it's really worth paying attention to Peter Thiel, because Zuckerberg is a really, really powerful figure. I mean, you know, he runs a media company that I think is the world's, is probably the largest and most powerful, you know, media entity in human history. You know, 3 billion users, and it's run by a guy who, you know, is unelected and who controls, you know, has absolute control over its board of directors. And no one really knows what he believes, except that maybe that Facebook should grow really big, really fast. And I think that's why, you know, and he's talking to Thiel, you know, all the time. And I think that's why we need to really look closely at this ideology and, you know, where appropriate, you know, criticize it, because it's having an impact on our lives every day. And it will continue to do so. I mean, Facebook has gotten a lot of bad press over the last 5 years, but I don't think it's any less powerful than it's been. I mean, it's grown. It's, you know, it's market cap, it's revenue, it's all gone up. So whatever people are doing to scrutinize it hasn't worked that well so far.
So just in closing, let's talk a little bit about the extent to which your book, as its subtitle, The Contrarian, the subtitle being Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. I mean, he founded PayPal, got into business with Elon Musk, and Thiel thinks that Musk's a fraud and a braggart, and Musk thinks that Thiel is a sociopath. But after he founded PayPal, and then he formed a hedge fund called Clarium, and then he had some problems with the crash. He lost a lot of money, and then became the first investor in Facebook, and has had a string of successes since. I mean, I think we've got Silicon Valley wrong. At least your book seems to correct that myth that these techno-utopians tend to be kind of liberal. They're not really, are they?
No. I mean, I think one thing that happened is there was a period where the tech industry was kind of an insurgent force, right? They were kind of on the outside looking in. The real power players were kind of Wall Street and, you know, the energy industry. You know, ExxonMobil is like the biggest company, right? Like going back 15 years ago. And so the sort of Thielist ideology, right, that you can kind of do whatever you want, do what it takes to kind of get bigger. You know, I think that maybe made a little bit more sense back then, right, when you're talking about these smaller companies. But of course, as the companies get bigger, they have maintained that ideology. It's not like they've said, oh, actually, now that our market cap is $2 trillion, you know, we're going to have a different relationship with institutions and regulators and so on. And so I think that's, you know, that's basically what happened. There have been these two threads, you know, running through the tech industry. One is, and the one that we usually hear about, is a counterculture, right? These kind of California hippies, you know, Steve Jobs, right, famously, you know, Reed College dropout, you know, didn't, you know, was a vegan, you know, he had all these, you know, kind of was a person of the counterculture. And a lot of the figures of the tech industry that kind of created the tech companies of the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s were kind of countercultural figures. But there's this other thread, and that's Silicon Valley as very closely connected with the military. You know, of course, it basically was the military industrial complex, you know, and you know, when it started in the 1950s. And also Silicon Valley as this force for extreme libertarianism, a libertarianism that says, you know, people should, that billionaires should be able to keep all their money, should be able to do whatever they want, you know, should be responsible to no one. And I think that at times has been interpreted as sort of somehow in keeping with the counterculture, because it's like, you know, free love, free billionaires or something. But I mean, it starts to seem increasingly absurd when you're talking about these companies with, you know, trillions of dollars in market cap, with extremely close connections to the U.S. government, you know, Palantir, of course, you know, helping the U.S. government target drone strikes, you know, and you know, in other words, kill people. And so I think there's just been this sense where we all sort of let ourselves get a little bit lulled to sleep about both the ambitions and the power of this industry. And there is, like, I am a big fan of technology, and I think there's so much to admire, but I think we also have to be kind of clear-eyed about where it's gone wrong and where it needs to be held to account.
Well, Max Chafkin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Max Chafkin, who's a feature editor and tech reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek, whose work has also appeared in Fast Company, Vanity Fair, Inc., and the New York Times Magazine, and is the author of the new book just out, The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the results of the German election and the surprise comeback of the Social Democrats, who will likely form a government with the Greens and the Liberals. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Berlin is Michael Wirth, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he works as a member of the national security team, focusing on the nexus of climate change, migration, and security, and emerging democracies, especially Turkey, Mexico, and Brazil. And he's been a senior transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund, where his work focuses on transatlantic foreign policy and the European Union. And he joins us from Berlin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Wirth.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, and you've had a very busy couple of days. The elections are a bit of a surprise, are they not, with the Social Democrats, who have been in the wilderness, although they dominated German politics for decades. Can they put a coalition together?
Right now, it seems as a very likely scenario that the German government, the new German government, will be formed by a three-party coalition led by the lead candidate for Chancellor Olaf Scholz in the German Social Democratic Party, who has experience as a finance minister and has an extensive record as a public figure in Germany. And he will need two additional smaller parties to form a coalition to establish an absolute majority in the German parliament and the Bundestag. So he will try to negotiate a coalition with the German Green Party, which is an center-left environmental party, and the German Liberal Party, which is a center-right pro-business party. Those negotiations will probably start later this week or early next week. And the assumption here in Berlin is that they might be able to put together a coalition rather quickly. And the expectation also is that possibly by mid to end November, there will be a new German government in Berlin.
But at this point, the head of the Christian Democrats, who was nominally Merkel's successor, Armin Laschet, he's not giving up, is he? I mean, he's saying that he's got a chance of putting together a coalition.
Yes. So he is slightly changing his position. He gave a press conference yesterday evening, German time, after the election, and was still trying to position himself as a possible candidate for chancellor, even though the Christian Democratic, the German Conservative Party, came in second after a fairly dramatic loss of almost one third of their vote compared to 4 years ago. But he has slightly adapted that position today after internal criticism from his own party, where people probably rightly said, you lose 30% of your support, you come in second after the Social Democratic Party, which indeed has been a surprise. You can seriously argue that you should be the next German chancellor. So he said that he would be ready to lead the country in case other coalition options would not work out.
So is that to say that Merkel herself was the glue that held the Christian Democrats together?
Yes, I mean, in part, that's true. There are no term limits for German chancellors, so she has been in power for 16 years, which obviously is a long time. Many would legitimately say it's too long, because if you are in power for 16 years, this has a tendency to hollow out the party, get yourself into a position where there's relatively little and few high-level personnel left that hasn't been seen by the public and that hasn't been involved in political confrontation. So there was no clear-cut successor for her. Angela Merkel also has not been a person that has been strengthening a new generation of conservative leaders in Germany that she could have put into a position to be more successful in a succession election. And she also does not have the very best relationship with Armin Laschet, the CDU elite candidate, and only in the last week and a half or 2 weeks of the federal election campaign, she has actually actively campaigned for him, and that might have been too late.
So, but she's still going to be around for a while. If you say it'll take them till November to get a government together, it may even be longer, but it sounds like Laschet's going to sort of back down. Is that what you're telling us?
This is right now the situation here in Berlin. So the Social Democratic Party will enter negotiations or the first round of conversations about possible coalition treaties with the German Green Party and the German Liberal Party. Those conversations are very likely to be successful. And as long as the coalition is an option, the conservative candidate has to stand down. And indeed, there will be a lame duck government in Germany until the new government comes into power. But there's also consensus that coalition negotiations have to be speedy because 2022 is an important with elections, federal elections in France and in Italy, two key members of the European Union, the G20 summit, a lot of obligations for German leadership within the EU after the Brits have left the Union last year. So everybody knows that they can't drag out those coalition negotiations for another 2, 3, 4, or 5 months. That would be unthinkable.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Wirth, who's in Berlin. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he works as a member of the National Security Team, focusing on the nexus of climate change, migration and security, and emerging democracies, especially Turkey, Mexico, and Brazil. And he's been a senior transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund, where his work focuses on transatlantic foreign policy and the European Union. So just to do the math here, you've got the Social Democrats coming in with 206 seats out of the total of 735. Mm-hmm. And the Christian Democrats got 196 seats. The Greens got 118. The Liberals got 92. AfD, the right-wing party, 83. And Die Linke, the left-wing Eastern party, I guess it is, got 39, right?
Yes.
So just to put the SDP's 206 together with the Greens, 118, and the Liberals, 92, is that enough?
So there are only two options possible right now, which are both three-party coalitions, which is the first one that will generate an absolute majority in the German parliament. German parliament will have to elect the chancellor. The chancellor is not elected directly, like in the United States, it is the case with the president, but the parliament will elect the chancellor. So there are two three-party coalitions that are possible right now or feasible, which is one is the Social Democratic Party in an alliance with the Green Party and the Liberals, and the other one would be the Conservative Party, the CDU, in an alliance with those two parties, the Greens and the Liberals. These are the only two constellations that are politically viable and would generate an absolute majority in German parliament.
But isn't there more affinity between the Social Democrats and the Greens than there is between the Christian Democrats and the Greens?
Yes, indeed. So the German Green Party is a center-left party. It is not to be confused with the Green Party in the United States, which is much more dogmatic and leftist than this is the case in Germany. The German Green Party is a party of urban middle classes that has been part of the federal government before quite successfully. That the Green Party is part of about a dozen state governments at the state level. So this is a party that is pretty much established within the center of German society and has, I would say, about a 90% overlap in terms of their political goals and the policy issues that are important to them with the Social Democratic Party. So the negotiations between Social Democrats and Greens should be relatively easy. The center-right Liberal Party is a little bit more difficult to deal with from a perspective of a future Social Democratic Chancellor, because they are very much opposed to tax increases or deficit spending, which is obviously part of a new progressive German government program where they try to attempt to successfully transform German industries into a 21st century more sustainable economic entity.
So the Green leader, Annalena Baerbock, they didn't gain a lot of seats, did they not? I mean, for them it was disappointing, even though she'll end up probably in this coalition that we're talking about.
Yes. So the German Green Party actually had the best result in its history, but somebody very accurately said yesterday this is the party that is the first party to be very sad about the best election result ever, because there has been quite unusual for Germany, a massive volatility in the opinion polls starting in March of this year. Just to give you an example, in March and April of this year, about half year before the election, the Social Democratic Party that ended up with about 26-27% of the vote was at 15%. The German Green Party that got a little less than 15% of the vote was at almost 30%. And the CDU, the Conservative Party, was about 10 to 12 points higher than the actual election result from yesterday. So there was a fairly substantial shift of voting patterns, less within the two camps, the progressives versus the conservatives. The two camps, their overall vote haven't really changed that much. But the redistribution of votes among the parties on both sides of the political spectrum has changed quite dramatically. And so, indeed, the Greens underperformed. They had very high hopes. And at some point this summer, they were even toying with the idea that they could come in first, even before the on top of the Social Democratic and Christian Democratic parties, and actually have a candidate that could become Chancellor of Germany. That has not materialized.
And AfD, the right-wing party, they didn't do, in fact, they did more poorly than they did last time, didn't they? And Die Linke barely made the threshold.
Yes, sorry. That's exactly right. The AfD, the Alternative for Germany, is a neo-fascist right-wing party, which has lost votes at the federal level, which is interesting. It seems that their potential is being topped out at 10, maybe 11% of the electorate, which was a reason for a great sigh of relief here in Germany, as you might imagine. Having a party with neo-fascist sympathies in the German parliament is quite something for post-war Germany. And even more interestingly, there were two state elections that were held last Sunday as well, one in a rural eastern German region and the other one in the city state of Berlin. And in both those elections, the AfD, the right-wing party, lost about between 30% to half of its support. And so there seems to be an indication that they have might have passed their apex, at least in the short term, and will not be able to consolidate themselves as a strong force in German politics the way the party members were hoping for.
And, Michael, earlier I mentioned how the Social Democrats dominated German politics for decades, but then went into a kind of wilderness or collapse in a curious way. And that's across the board. It happened in other European countries as well, where the equivalent of the Social Democratic parties in Italy and France, etc., seem to implode. What happened then, and what has happened to reverse that?
That's a very good question. I think there's a number of issues at play here. One, Germany is not an isolated case, because you had more progressive, more liberal governments voted into office or back into office in the United States. You had Justin Trudeau defend his position in Canada. You have a new progressive government in Norway. So this seems to be a development that goes beyond Germany, which obviously has to do with several factors. I think one of those factors is that people increasingly concerned about economic globalization are looking for more state action and more social and security support within their respective societies, be it healthcare, be it social services, be it lowering the cost of education. And then obviously that attitude has been strengthened by the experiences of the year and a half long pandemic that we are still all suffering through, because it became, at least in the European continent, clear that state services, a healthy state infrastructure, free or at least not extremely costly healthcare, are not only things that are nice to have, but that they also have helped Europe to weather the economic implications of the pandemic much better than many other countries in the world, including the United States. All of that, I think, by and large, is benefiting social democratic and liberal parties. And the recent elections that I've mentioned seem to indicate that people are revisiting their concern that social democratic parties were overly bureaucratic, were overspending, and were not really capable of leading modern societies into the 21st century. There seems to have been quite a considerable change of attitudes.
And in terms of the fall or the reduction of the seats for the neo-fascist AfD party, what explains that? Is it to do with the fact that they had a surge both in Germany and in Sweden mm-hmm. in reaction to the influx of refugees from Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, etc.? And now, has that changed? Have attitudes changed in Germany?
I would assume not much, but Germany was also a slightly different case than the Scandinavian countries, and not even to speak about the Eastern European countries, which had some of the most ruthless policies, anti-immigrants and anti-refugees. In Germany, the situation has been more complex, which had to do with Chancellor Merkel's leadership in 2015, when over a million refugees came into Germany from Syria and other countries within a relatively short time period. And that experience hit the country and the German bureaucracy completely unprepared and caused a lot of political fallout. And this also coincided with the strengthening of right-wing and right-extremist voting patterns. But at the same time, in 2016 and 2017, not only the German bureaucracy managed to process those immigrants and refugees and figure out ways to teach German language and skill sets that now got over 50% of those refugees into the German labor market, but also at some point in time in 2016, over 8 million Germans were voluntarily engaged in refugee work in one way or another, which meant that 10% of German society actually actively tried to help refugees to arrive in Germany and to integrate in Germany into the labor market and acquire the cultural and the linguistic skills that you need to be successful in the European society. So I think the situation in Germany is slightly different than it is in other countries. Interestingly so, because Germany is still grappling with the fact that it has become a country, an immigration destination over the course of the last 25 to 30 years. The society is much more diverse than it was only a few decades ago. But it seems that there's a considerable segment of German society that is still welcoming to new arrivals in German society. At the same time, you have about 15 to 20% of the voters that are vulnerable to new fascist and right-wing extremist and xenophobic demagogues. So that is something that not only Germany, but Europe at large will have to deal with over the course of the next decade or so.
So just in closing, Angela Merkel had I wouldn't call it a close relationship with Vladimir Putin. It's often contentious and he famously, because she's afraid of dogs, he famously brought in a huge dog to terrify her in a meeting that they had. But she seems to be able to handle him and talk to him, and she speaks Russian, etc. So what do you think is going to happen with that relationship under Olaf Scholz's leadership, if indeed he becomes a chancellor?
Yes, I mean there will be no change when it comes to pushing back against Russian interference in German elections, which happened again this Sunday. The aggressive and militarized foreign policy that the Putin regime is conducting in Eastern Europe, and the constant threats against NATO allies in Eastern Europe, and much less so when it comes to the situation inside Russia, because the Social Democratic Party and especially the Green Party, if they both form part of the government coalition, they will have a keen eye on human rights violations inside Russia and the deteriorating capacity of Russians to actually access news media and voice their opinion freely. So I would assume that in the overall posture in Germany, not much will change. And also Olaf Scholz, as a chancellor and a convinced transatlanticist, will make sure that Germany and the United States have a strong and stable working relationship. And obviously the U.S. Position vis-a-vis Russia is harsh and very, very forward-leaning. And I think that's something that he will adapt as well. So I wouldn't anticipate any substantial changes in the German way of looking at Russia and dealing with the authoritarian Russian leadership.
Well, Michael Wirtz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian. It was a pleasure.
And I've been speaking with Michael Wirtz, who's in Berlin. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he works as a member of the national security team, focusing on the nexus of climate change, migration and security, and emerging democracies, especially Turkey, Mexico and Brazil. And he's been a senior transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund, where his work focuses on transatlantic foreign policy and the European Union. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast. And we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.